Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. We are listening to Luciano Pavarotti sing one of the great arias of the operatic tradition, Nessun Dorma, from Puccini's Turandot. And in this episode, we will explore one of music's most commonly used instruments, the solo voice. In our segment, Sounds of Scripture, we will explore the great singers and solo repertoire of the biblical record. Our segment's Classroom Corner and Backstage Banter will include an interview with the most beautiful soprano in the world, and I know this because she's my wife, soprano Paula Malone. She is a voice instructor here at Herbert W. Armstrong College and frequent performer at Armstrong Auditorium, who has collaborated with musical giants such as Marvin Hamlisch, the Eroica Trio, and the Romero Guitar Quartet. With her, we will discuss the best age for young people to begin one-on-one vocal instruction.
The mechanism just needs to be matured enough to handle the demands that this art form would put on it.
She'll also let us in on some secrets on how we can appreciate and enjoy vocal performances even more.
Every performer wants to make an emotional contact with their audience. The composer wrote these beautiful melodies over these gut-wrenching harmonies sometimes, and it's meant to speak to human emotion. Let them take you on a roller coaster ride. That's really what it's about.
All this on today's episode of Music for Life, The Human Instrument. The human voice is a remarkable instrument. Some say it is the only earthly instrument made directly by God. Whether you believe that or not, it is a common occurrence in music for instrumentalists to try to imitate the sound of the human voice. The voice has the ability to sustain pitches for as long as the singer's lung capacity will allow. Instruments that operate on the plucking or striking of strings, like pianos, guitars, or harps, are not able to do this, and yet they strive to emulate the human voice when playing a musical phrase. Many instruments are bound to finite half steps and whole steps in terms of the pitches they can produce, but the human voice is capable of, literally, an infinite number of pitches along the spectrum of its range. And unlike any other instrument, it is capable of conveying not just pitches, but text. Composers throughout history have exploited nearly every corner of its range, every color it can produce, and some remarkable music has been created. So we will go through music history and talk about the types of pieces that were favored in these particular eras. And as we do, I can introduce you to some of the different voice types that there are. But then when we get into our backstage banter segment, I'll have our special guest give us more insight into all the different voice types that composers have required of the human voice. It's more than just soprano, alto, tenor, bass, as you might be thinking. Before we get into our discussion of standard music history, I want to go further back in time and discuss the way the solo human voice was treated in biblical times. So let's move into our first segment for today's show, Sounds of Scripture, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. In this segment today, we will explore the great solo singers of the Bible, as well as repertoire as recorded in the Bible that was intended for the solo voice. One time in piano lessons, I called something I was working on a song, and my teacher said, "A song you sing, a piece you play." It's easy to refer to all musical pieces as songs. Oh, I love that song, or that song he played. But there is a distinction, especially when you study all the varied kind of literature out there. Then when I went to college, I learned that song was a specific genre in classical vocal music that was distinguished from choral repertoire and even from some solo opera repertoire. Song was a specific kind of vocal music. Each language even had its own label that we still use today because these national styles of song were quite different from each other. German Lieder, L-I-E-D-E-R, was remarkably different from French chanson, C-H-A-N-S-O-N, even though each of those words literally refer to songs in each particular language. Now, the Bible makes a similar distinction between songs and other types of compositions for the human voice. In the New Testament, the Jewish-born Apostle Paul twice made the distinction between psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Each had a slightly different musical and perhaps sacred function. So if we go back to the Old Testament, the compositions Paul would have been referencing, we can see some of these distinctions in the titles or inscriptions of the psalms, and those inscriptions are part of the original Hebrew text. 59 of the 150 chapters in the book of Psalms are noted as psalms in the inscriptions. 5 are identified as prayers. 13 are maskil, a Hebrew word which has an uncertain meaning but likely indicating that of teaching, learning, or being educated. But 30 of these psalms, or 30 of these chapters in the book of Psalms, are called songs, the Hebrew word shir, transliterated S-H-I-Y-R, shir. Again, even our recent musical history differentiates between song, lieder, chanson, depending on the geographic location and language, and other vocal works like airs or arias and recitatives. Now, what distinction the Hebrews placed between songs and psalms, between shir and mizmor, is not exactly clear. The general categories seem to survive the centuries till Paul's day, where he said there was a distinction, and the Greek can perhaps give us more insight into these differences, but nothing conclusive. To make matters even more elusive, of the 30 shir, of the 30 songs in the book of Psalms, 13 of them are listed as both a psalm and song, or a psalm song, mizmor shir. Based on the presence of lyrics and the word shir, we certainly can surmise, at the very least, that these probably included a solo human voice. Another phrase in these psalm titles that may have indicated solo singing is the phrase, "to the chief musician," found at the heading of 55 psalms, and that's the English phrase as it is translated in the King James Version. Hebrew scholars have contemplated the many conceivable meanings of this phrase in Hebrew, la menatzach. Its root, natzach, is used elsewhere in the Bible and means to shine, to be bright, to excel, to lead, to superintend. Its use outside the Psalms usually involves the act of overseeing. In his book, Music in Ancient Israel, Alfred Sendri writes this, "Menatzeah is the singer chosen to lead the music or to officiate as precentor, who probably instructed the choir or at least supervised rehearsals and was a specially qualified artist with a superior musical knowledge. Furthermore, he must have been entrusted with the occasional solo passages in psalm singing. Thus, he may be considered the precursor of latter days Hazan, the presenter of the synagogal service." And that's a quote from Alfred Sendri's book, Music in Ancient Israel. But as he asks, however, why do only 55 of the Psalms carry this inscription? He speculates, there are relevant indications that La Menetzea was only put at the head or at the end of such psalms which either were designated to be sung by a soloist or which contained passages for a solo singer. The other psalms were performed by the choir alone. There seems to be a remarkable affinity between psalm singing in ancient Israel and one of the vocal forms of our Occidental or Western music, the cantata. A comparative scrutiny will reveal a striking similarity between the formal principle of the two. So he's talking about the connections between these psalms and our Western cantatas. We'll talk about cantatas a little bit later. These 55 psalms could be either a solo cantata or a mixed cantata where there's choir and soloists alternating, perhaps comprised of several movements. Sendri writes, "The alternation of the subjects I and we within the same psalms justifies the assumption that these psalms were originally congregational songs which must have been performed antiphonally by the presenter as soloist and the worshipers in the capacity of a responding choral body." So he's talking about the fact that the lyrics sometimes say I and then sometimes they say we, and that would indicate the alternating between, well, this is where the choir would sing or the congregation would sing, and this is where the soloist or the lead vocalist would sing. Psalm 5 is a prime example of this. Verses 1 to 3 are in the first person. Verses 4 to 6 are in the second person, addressing God. Verses 7 and 8 are back to the first person. Verses 9 to 12 address God again. So this isn't a case of I versus we, but this is a case of singing in the first person and then singing to God, and then singing in the first person again, and then addressing God. Some psalms are obviously better suited for soloist alone, based on the lyrics, like a solo cantata, and Sendri suggests Psalm 13 and Psalm 54 for that. As the Hebrew root implies, it was an opportunity for the leader or the virtuoso singer of the day to shine or triumph, but as Sendri explains, not for his own glory, but, quote, for the higher glory of God in whose honor the sacred music was performed, unquote. Along these lines, the Bible discusses men and women who were known for their singing. First of all, the occupation of singing is given great prominence in the Hebrew Bible. In the grand temple plans, as discussed in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48, specific mention is made of the chambers of the singers in the inner court. Singers were given special prominence in the moving of the ark back to Jerusalem by King David. They were given a special place in the dedication of the first temple by King Solomon. They were also given a special role in a war under King Jehoshaphat, where he was told that God would fight the battle for him. They were prominent in Hezekiah's temple restoration. They are especially noted in the genealogies and lists of those returning to Jerusalem after the 70-year Babylonian captivity. They often occupied their own special villages. Nehemiah mentions that they even administrated some of the business affairs of the Second Temple. Singing was not restricted to a specific gender. Solomon employed men singers and women singers. The prophetesses Deborah and Miriam are known for their prowess as singers. Back to the moving of the Ark of the Covenant under King David, there was a particular man mentioned who was to lead or train the singers because of his skill, Chenaniah. The Hebrew indicates that he was to help them lift up their voices, and much of the purpose of singing coaches and choral conductors is to get the voice to produce the most resonance possible. After King David brought the Ark back to Jerusalem, he set three men in particular over the musical service surrounding the Ark: Yeduthun, Asaph, and Heman. All three were noted as accomplished singers. Asaph's descendants were given special mention among the singers in Ezra's and Nehemiah's time. Heman, another star musician from David's court, was the grandson of the prophet Samuel, mentioned specifically as Heman a singer in the genealogies of 1 Chronicles 6, and he had sons and daughters who also served in the temple as gifted singers, as 1 Chronicles 25 verse 6 shows. Now back to the distinctions between the types of vocal compositions there were. Even outside these psalm titles, within the flow of the Hebrew text, many of the commands to perform music in the Bible also make a distinction between singing, the Hebrew word shir, and the notion of singing praises, which comes from the Hebrew root meaning to pluck. Deborah's song in Judges 5 verse 3 reads, "Hear, O ye kings, give ear, O ye princes. I, even I, will sing, shir, unto the Eternal. I will sing praise, samar, to the Eternal God of Israel." In David's psalm, composed after returning the ark to Jerusalem, he says, "Give thanks unto the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him, shir, sing psalms unto him, samar, talk of all his wondrous works." And that can be found in 1 Chronicles 16, verses 8 to 9. And again, the New Testament maintains certain distinctions in vocal music, psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. The Greek for the word songs is where we get our word ode, O-D-E. But in two places that word is used, it is referring to heavenly music, the ode of the 144,000 first fruits, see Revelation 14, and the ode of Moses and of the Lamb sung by a group of spirit beings. So the word in the Greek doesn't necessarily distinguish between a solo singer and that of a chorus. And here it certainly couldn't technically qualify as the human instrument because of its performance by beings composed of spirit. One more interesting thing about singing, as referenced in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul says we can be singing, the verb form of that word where we get our word ode, a difference between that and making melody, again, psalo, making melody in your heart to the Lord. The singing and plucking, in other words, can happen literally, or it can happen in your heart. Now, this brings up an interesting thought about music that's in our minds or in our hearts. Anthony Storr writes how music drawn from the memory has many of the same effects as real music coming from the external world, and that's quoted in Oliver Sacks's book, Musicophilia. So that means the effects that music has on the brain, sometimes it's not even effects of external music, it can be just thinking of the music. Daniel Levitin, in his book, This Is Your Brain on Music, discussed an experiment that showed how, in brain scans, it was nearly impossible to tell from the data whether people were listening to music or imagining music. The pattern of brain activity, he said, was virtually indistinguishable. Dr. Oliver Sacks shows that, quote, "the imagination of music, of rhythm, may be as potent, neurally, as actually listening to it," unquote. The fact that music made in the mind has similar effects to external music confirms what the Apostle Paul was saying here to the Ephesians. Singing can be done in your heart, and it can have similar benefits to singing aloud. Dr. Sacks is convinced that we all, quote, "to varying degrees have music in our heads," unquote, and that music in our minds is not connected with the memory, but rather an active, present mental process. He says, remembering music is not, in the usual sense, remembering at all. Remembering music, listening to it, or playing it is entirely in the present. So you're not remembering something from the past, you're actually reproducing it in the present. All this reinforces for the Christian the importance of having godly music in the mind. This has been Sounds of Scripture.
Imagine how God can sing, how his voice delights the universe, with a range that blends eternally into chords of his love.
You are listening to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are discussing the human instrument, particularly some of the great music composed for the solo voice. One of the most common treatments of the solo human voice was to pair it with one other instrument for accompaniment. This was certainly the case back in the medieval and Renaissance eras. In those days, the voice was often accompanied by a lute. Some who played the lute and sang were given certain prominence in the medieval courts. These poet singers or minstrels had specific labels or names depending on the region they were from. You've probably heard of a troubadour, and that's the term applied to those in the region of southern France, northern Spain, and northern Italy. The female counterpart is a trobaritz. These minstrels who flourished in northern France during the late Middle Ages were known as trouvères, and in Germany they were known as minnesingers. All these poet musicians are part of the secular music of the medieval period, as the sacred vocal music was strictly governed by the state religion of Europe at the time, and instruments were banned from use in the church then. But during the Renaissance, things were starting to change culturally. There was a new emphasis on exploration, discovery, science, and reason. The Protestant Reformation had challenged the religious status quo, and this impacted music at this time. All sorts of vocal music was flourishing then, and music was coming out of a certain Dark Ages of sorts. And let's hear an example of a solo vocal work from the Renaissance accompanied by a lute. Here is a portion of the most commonly known song from the Renaissance, performed by Julianne Baird and Ron McFarlane on the lute. This is Green Sleeves, attributed to Henry VIII. That was Green Sleeves, performed by Julianne Baird with Ron McFarlane on the lute. You are listening to Music for Life, and today we are exploring the use of the solo voice in music history, and that was an example from the Renaissance era. Now, there are all sorts of solo vocal works being composed in the next era, the Baroque era. I think we can put them into one of three categories: opera, cantata, and oratorio. Opera developed in the late Renaissance and early Baroque eras out of a style of accompanied solo song known as monody. It started from composers stringing these types of songs together, and it evolved into the grand full-scale productions we know as opera today. That is, a combination of music and drama that is basically and entirely sung. Now, within opera, there are two types of solo vocal works. One is called recitative, and one is called aria. Aria is like the song. That's where the action stops, an idea is sung about for several minutes, usually involving a lot of repeated text. Recitative, on the other hand, is very functional, just delivering text, maybe in a conversation, or maybe just getting information across. So you have recitative, moving the story along, and then you have aria, where the story or the action stops so a singer can dwell on an idea. Here is an example of a mezzo-soprano by the name of Cecilia Bartoli singing a recitative from an opera by Antonio Vivaldi. The opera's called L'Olimpiade. You will hear what's called a dry recitative, where the singer is accompanied by an occasional chord from the orchestra, basically just the section of the orchestra where there's just a harpsichord and a cello, known as the basso continuo section. So that's a dry recitative, just basic chords. She's getting a lot of text out at this time. And the singing is free and more conversational-like in this section. But then when the aria starts, you clearly hear that in the orchestra coming in at a steady tempo. So I'll play the recitative and just the opening of the aria. So that was mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli with the ensemble Il Giardino Armonico performing a recitative and aria from Antonio Vivaldi's opera L'Olimpiade. Now, you heard the recitative, a lot of harpsichord, just playing chords. She was getting out a lot of text. And then you heard a very steady tempo come in when the entire orchestra entered. That began the aria. There was a long instrumental introduction, and then the singer, in this case the mezzo-soprano, comes in to start the vocal part of the aria. Recitative and aria were also present in the other major genres of the Baroque era that employed the solo voice. One of those that we'll discuss now is the cantata. The word cantata literally means to be sung, as opposed to the sonata, which means to sound. So whereas the sonata implied an instrumental work, cantata implied a vocal work. And it was designed to be performed in a smaller setting than an opera. The lyrics generally convey a single situation, or a brief, non-complex narrative, as opposed to a full-scale opera with several scenes and plots and richer character development. Cantata was perhaps to opera what skits or shorts are to whole movies today. It was usually just a few movements, perhaps a couple of recitatives and arias, and maybe lasted 15 to 30 minutes long on average. They could be secular or religious. The master of this genre was Johann Sebastian Bach. He wrote 300 cantatas between the years 1723 and 1750. Many of them were written as sacred music for church services. These musical interludes were intended to break up what might be a 4 or 5 hour long church service. There are so many religious cantatas, but I want to play a secular example here because of its subject matter. The cantata is the coffee cantata. It's made up of 10 movements And it's written for a baritone and soprano mainly, but there's a tenor as well as more of a narrator. This is the part of this mini story where a girl, the soprano, and her father, the baritone, are having a disagreement about coffee. One more thing to note about this aria before I play it. The aria was in a certain form known as ternary form, that is a three-part form. And ternary form usually means a main section, a contrasting section, and then a repeat of the original main section, or what we would call with letters A theme, B theme, A theme, or A section, B section, A section. This was a form common to the arias written in the Baroque era, and they are often referred to as da capo arias, meaning that the composer wrote only the A section and the B section, and then at the end of that B section, or the end of that second section, the composer wrote da capo. And if you played music, you know what DC or da capo means. It means go back to the beginning, and the implication is go back to the beginning and play to the fine, or what looks like fine in English. So you'd go back and you'd play that first section again, and then at the end of the first section, there usually was the Italian word fine, meaning finish, right here. So the composers would write out the A section and the B section, and then make a note at the end, da capo. Go back to the beginning and play that A section again. So when you listen to it, it has a ternary form, A, B, and then the repeat of the A. So here is a recitative and aria from Bach's Coffee Cantata. In the recitative, you will hear the conversational quality of the music. In the recit, which is what we call recitative sometimes, in the recit, the father is asking the daughter to stop drinking coffee. So this recit, or this recitative, is actually a conversation that is sung. It lasts about 30 seconds. Then in the aria, which is clearly heard when the orchestra, led by a flute, comes in, the daughter sings about how much she loves coffee. And since the German word for coffee is so similar sounding to the English word for it, I think you'll be able to hear when she repeats this word over and over. Here it is performed by the Folyóni Chamber Orchestra of Budapest with bass István Gáti and soprano Ingrid Kertesi.
Herr Vater, sei doch nicht so scharf, wenn ich des Tages in Tränen und Schmerzen Kaffee trinken darf. So werd ich ja zu meiner Qual wie ein verdorrtes Ziegenbrötchen.
Thank you.
Coffee. That's what that aria was about. A daughter telling her father how much she loves coffee. In J.S. Bach's Coffee Cantata, there was a recitative, including a conversation between the father and the daughter, and an aria sung by the daughter. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today we are talking about the human instrument and music written for the solo voice. Right now, we're discussing the solo vocal music of the Baroque era, and we heard recitatives and arias from both a Vivaldi opera and from a Bach cantata. The other genre of music during the Baroque era that utilized the solo voice was oratorio. Oratorio developed in the Baroque era when it was determined that opera should not be performed during Lent. An oratorio is very much like an opera, except for the fact that there is no scenery, acting, or dancing. It's just the story being sung to the audience in a more static presentation. So other than that difference with opera, oratorio has recitatives and arias for the solo voice as well. The most famous oratorio has to be George Frideric Handel's Messiah. This doesn't contain as much of a story in the traditional dramatic sense, rather a compilation of scriptures about the prophesied coming, the life, death, and resurrection of the Messiah. Let's hear an example of a tenor. These are two movements of Handel's Messiah. One is a recitative, basically a sung recitation of necessary information, no repeated text, to set up the aria. Then comes the aria, titled, Thou Shalt Break Them with a Rod of Iron. Here it is performed by tenor John Ayler with Andrew Davis conducting the Toronto Symphony Orchestra.
He that dwelleth in heaven shall laugh them to scorn. The Lord shall have them in derision. Like a potter's vessel.
You are listening to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. This is KPCG. And that was a recitative and an aria from Handel's Messiah, performed by John Ayler, tenor, and conductor Andrew Davis and the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. And if you're familiar with Messiah, you know that that recitative and aria are what precede the famous chorus, Hallelujah. So we've discussed three genres of music in the Baroque era that incorporated the solo voice, and we used examples from three great Baroque composers, a recitative and aria from a Vivaldi opera, a recitative and aria from a Bach cantata, and a recitative and aria from a Handel oratorio. Now, moving into the classical era, there's still a great deal of opera being written, and some oratorio. Arguably, the most important music being written for the solo human voice at this time could be found in the operas of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. In his opera, The Magic Flute, he wrote both the highest notes and some of the lowest notes ever sung. The two contrasting characters, Zarathustra and his nemesis, the Queen of the Night, are represented respectively by the lowest bass voice to the highest soprano voice. Listen to some of the low notes that the bass playing Zarathustra has to sing. That was Cornelius Hauptmann performing the role of Zarathustra, the low bass, in Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. Zarathustra is represented by a low bass. His nemesis, the Queen of the Night, on the other hand, has to sing the highest pitches ever written for the soprano voice. This character sings only two arias in this opera, and both use the F above what's commonly referred to as high C. Here's where she sings the high F in her first aria. First of all, there's several high Ds, and then the last high note she sings is a high F. That was Beverly Hoch singing The Queen of the Night from Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. And that was where she sings the high F in her first aria, but the second aria, she has to sing the high F more frequently, and this became one of the most famous soprano arias and one of Mozart's more famous pieces of all time. Here is Der Hölle Rache kocht in meinem Herzen. Again, she's the bad guy, and she's singing about vengeance boiling in her heart and wanting to take down Zarathustra. These high notes are supposed to make her sound intimidating. So here is, again, Beverly Hawke singing this aria with Roger Norrington and the London Classical Players. That was the most famous aria from Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. Today on Music for Life, we are discussing the human instrument, exploring the great repertoire composed for the solo voice. The piece we just heard utilized the highest pitches ever written for a soprano voice. And if you've ever sung in a choir, you've probably heard of the basic four voice parts, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. But even in these four areas, there are so many different kinds of voices. Not all sopranos, for instance, can perform the high F required in the Queen of the Night's arias. Not that they can't hit the note, but the way the pitches are approached and performed are less feasible for some sopranos than others. The soprano who joins us for our next segment is one who has performed the Queen of the Night before. So let's move into our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. And for this segment, I'm interviewing the most beautiful soprano in the world, my wife, Paula Malone. And she can explain this idea that even within the category of soprano, there are some who can sing higher, some who sing louder, some who sing better on faster notes, some who can hold pitches longer. And it has to do with the kinds of sopranos they are. And all of these various subcategories exist within the other voice parts as well. So to talk about that, let's welcome Paula Malone. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, she is a voice instructor here at Herbert W. Armstrong College and frequent performer at Armstrong Auditorium, who has collaborated with some of the stars who've come through here, such as Marvin Hamlisch, the Eroica Trio, and the Romero Guitar Quartet. Thanks for joining me, Paula.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I finally get to see what you do.
So talk to us about these subcategories. Talk about that a little bit.
the very first consideration for categories of voices is the range of the instrument. So like that would be those main categories of soprano, mezzo-soprano, contralto, tenor, baritone, bass baritone, and bass. Those are the main categories.
Right. So you've subdivided it more than even what I did or what a choir situation kind of does. So,
yes.
And that's all based on, like you said, range.
That's flatly based on range. How high can you sing? What's your lowest note that you can sing? Beyond that, there are really about four main characteristics that come into play whenever you're going to be doing specific roles for operas or oratorio. And they would be tessitura, timbre, weight, and agility. Tessitura is a very small section of your voice. It could be like the place in your voice where it is the easiest for you to sing and it has the most beautiful facility and quality and where you are just really able to do artistic things. Then there's timbre, and timbre is like the voice's color, the voice's tone quality. Usually a richer timbre will be assigned, say, to a mezzo-soprano versus a clearer, more bell-like timbre would generally be given to a soprano. Mezzo-sopranos and sopranos often have very similar ranges. Their tessituras will be different, and their timbre will be different. Then there are differences in weight.
And this isn't how big the soprano is.
No, it's not. It's how big her voice is. And what that means is not necessarily even how loud it is, but how much she can cut through an orchestra or whatever ensemble she is singing with. There are certain roles that those voices need to sing. A lighter voice is typically more agile, and that's the next characteristic is agility. Weight and agility aren't exclusive of each other, but they often are, in that the heavier the voice, the less agile, and then the lighter the voice, the more agile. And those characteristics also apply to the characters that you represent on stage. This is where a brilliant composer would, you know, give roles with great deal of angst or emotional woe. That's going to be to a bigger voice. They're going to be to the dramatic voices. The younger, more flirtatious type roles are going to be to the little coloratura voices, the lighter voices. They fit each other better. And that's standard how it's done.
So you're mentioning composers who are making this idea apparent in the music they're writing. Say, it's evident sometimes in the orchestration. Wagner has to be sung by a dramatic soprano. But, you know, did Wagner decide that himself? Or, what is it that's making that requirement?
These categorizations of voice types or Fach evolved over time. Back in Mozart's day, Fach didn't exist. Every trained singer was expected to be able to do everything.
And Fach, you mean the Fach, German word F-A-C-H.
Yes.
And that is basically these voice categories that
we're
talking about.
These voice categories are called Fach, yes. And so, as I said, every singer had to sing fast, had to sing high, had to sing low, had to sustain, had to be able to do everything. Then over time, definitely the orchestrations got thicker. The halls got bigger. The space that the voice needed to fill and the brass that they needed to sing over became much more of a challenge to smaller voices. So that's when the opera companies really started to categorize roles.
And when we move into the Romantic era in this particular episode, I'll play you some examples of these more lyric and dramatic singers who have to sing over this massive orchestra that was developing in this time period.
We're going to hear more from Paula Malone when we come back, and she's going to tell us how we can enjoy vocal performances even more. Here are some tips you won't want to miss. This is Music for Life. We'll be right back.